inviting me to be here. Okay, recording is now in progress. And I'll hit gut it. And that's done. And it's so great to be out here in California with them again. My wife and I, who is in one of the other squares, Claire N., we lived out in California for 26 years. That's where we met Brian and Laurie. And Northern California, Southern California, back to Massachusetts, back to California. So at this particular time in our lives, especially in the last week, it is absolutely fabulous to be here, because right before we left, we had a 24-inch snowstorm with 60-mile-an-hour winds. And then that was about a 24-hour thing. And then we had a two-day break, just enough time to get on a plane and get out here. And yesterday, and for part of today, there's a big ice storm that's paralyzed everything out there. So, and right now I'm looking outside Brian's back door and looking at a vineyard, green grass, sun outside, walked outside in a shirt and everything today. And it's good to be here. So thank you very much for having me. And I will follow the format. It's my job to tell my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And again, thank you for having me. And, you know, I grew up on Army bases. I'm the oldest of six. My father was Army Master Sergeant. We moved 20 times before I was 10. And so I always felt like I was the new kid on the block. And mainly because I always was the new kid on the block. And, you know, I've got to get this view off of me here. Give me one second. Okay, let's go. Okay, much better. I get tired of looking at myself. Sometimes I get tired of hearing myself too. So, but looking at myself is better. Now I can see everybody out there. Hi, everybody. Good to see you. So I moved 20 times before I was 10. Loving family. You know, father played baseball with me, you know, mother was just a sweetheart. And, you know, I don't really have any outside reasons why life was so terrible out there, you know, and it's, I can't blame my alcoholism on anything that my parents did. I may have one brother that, you know, he doesn't acknowledge it, but he's got a bit of a problem. But outside of that, I'm the only member in the family that has that. But I just happen to be one of those people that was born with that. And as I've gone through and worked my AA program with a lot of inventory, that's a lot of ongoing inventory, I've been able to look back and see. And one of the biggest lines that they talk about in the big book is that we are bodily and mentally different. And I can acknowledge that right from the beginning, I was mentally different. You know, I wasn't drinking early in my young age, you know, before 10, that's for sure. But I always had this feeling that people were watching me. I never really measured up. I wasn't good enough. And I was always looking for outside things to validate me. And I was always falling short. Not for lack of effort or anything, though. But we moved, when I was 10 years old, we moved to this little town right outside of Worcester, Massachusetts, called Auburn. And it was sort of a middle class town. And we were probably lower middle class, and that was a stretch. And so I go into the school system where everybody's known each other for years and everything. And here I am, the new kid on the block. And it was just like, man, it was just discomfort all over again. And as a little aside, my first day to school, I was dropped off in the middle of the day. Somebody walked me out to the recess because it was just getting ready to come out. So they said, hey, you'll be out in recess and then we'll come out and get you. So the recess started, out everybody went, and this big galoot came walking up to me and realized I'm the new kid on the block. So he said, I don't know you, who are you? And I said, I'm Mike. And he said, oh, okay, let me show you something. Grabbed me, bent me over a bicycle rack, jumped on my back and knocked me out on the ground, said, welcome to Auburn. And so that was my welcome to Auburn. So I was always feeling like a little bit of discomfort. But in those days, I had a little bit of an outlet. I loved playing baseball. And what I find back from looking at my personality, I was a left-handed pitcher. And the pitcher is the one that was in control. And I found that that was sort of an acknowledgement of that's something that I could do and enjoy very much, because I did three things. I could either strike them out, walk them, or hit them. And it all depends upon whether I liked them or not, whichever one I did with that. And I had a lot of fun with that my first couple of years doing that. Then went into junior high, and that was a whole different aspect. You got people from all over, all around, and I'm really feeling out of sorts. But then the magic happened. All of a sudden, a couple of guys said, come on, let's go out. Let's go out and do what we used to call tapping a Harry, where you go out and you find a wino. You say, I'll buy you a pint of wine if you'll buy me a six pack of beer. And the wino did it. He was very happy with his pint of wine. And he bought us a king size six pack of Colt 45 malt liquor. And from there, my life changed. There is a chapter two in our big book says there is a solution. And this chapter of my life, I found the solution for how I felt. Because when I took that first can, Colt 45 malt liquor, opened up that can, this shy, insecure, very uncomfortable kid took a couple of sips. And if you're familiar with David Banner and the Incredible Hulk, you know, all of a sudden this little meek, shy, insecure kid, one sip down, two sip down, I felt something coursing through my veins. And it was like, oh God. And I finished that first one. Then I opened up the second one, finished that second one. And this is a guy that I could not talk with a member of the opposite sex. It was just, I was so shy, so insecure. But I walked into that junior high school dance and I walked up to the best looking girl there and I pointed my finger at her and I said, you will dance with me. And to this day, I still remember the song. It was Little Latin Loopy Lou by Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, because I danced and I sweated and I had a good time. And what I found then at this particular time was it was okay to be me, to be me. And I didn't really care what you thought of me. Now, I was still, you know, my mother and father were, you know, they weren't, shall we say, loose with their kids or anything. And I couldn't go right out and do this every day of my life from there. But what I found there is I found an answer for how I felt. And as I got a little bit older and started doing a little bit more, and especially when I got into high school, my father was a military man that retired. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, so didn't have a lot of money, but their big night out was Friday night and Saturday night up the Knights of Columbus, and they would let us kids stay at home. So for me, that was, okay, they're out. I'm out with my friends. And this was the 60s and some wild times, some other assorted nonsense besides the alcohol got involved in there. But I can tell you 100% that for quite a while, alcohol was my solution and all the other things that went along with it during 1960s. And people talk about, I've heard people in AA talk about, you know, it was miserable right from the beginning. Well, I always say, if it was miserable right from the beginning, why the heck did you keep doing it? Because I had an absolute ball. I remember it was like in 1969, you know, middle row in Woodstock, you know, and it was just 1970, two friends and myself, we hitchhiked down to Provincetown and we rented a house in North Truro, and 30 of our friends followed us down. So we got evicted from that house after 30 days because, you know, that's the landlord happened to live right next door. So we went down into Provincetown and rented an apartment, and those same 30 friends followed us to the apartment, and we got evicted from there. And so bought a sleeping bag and a tent from the Army Navy surplus store, and went out to the woods with a couple of the friends and pitched the tent and the sleeping bag. And we were living out in the woods of Provincetown. Somebody stole the sleeping bag and the tent. And so went back to that Army Navy surplus store and got myself an Army Navy surplus blanket and a piece of plastic. And that's where we lived out in the woods, the summer of 70. And it was an absolute ball. We got our gallon bottles of, I'll always remember this wine, Napa Sonoma, Mendocino, Vin Rosé table wine. gallon bottle with wicker bamboo all around it. And we put it over our shoulders, drink it like this, thinking we're hot tickets. And then at night we'd sit there and get high doing other drugs and everything, drinking our wine and singing House of the Rising Sun. And it was just like, man, you just couldn't get a better life than this. Just couldn't. It was just absolutely a freeing, wonderful life. And, you know, in many ways, a lot of kids during their adolescence, teenage years, they go out and do the same thing. And, but for me, this was now, there was only one time I felt comfortable and I could do it 24/7. And it was just out there and running. Now I had another substance that I really liked very much along with this, and it was amphetamines. And I was diagnosed later on in life with ADHD. And I find that a lot of people that did amphetamines were actually had ADHD because it was a substitute for Ritalin that came on. I actually have a little brother in the Big Brother, Big Sister program, the same thing. You know, he went out on, what did they call it? He was a tweaker. That's what he called it later on. But, you know, as I go back and look through that, I say, you know, that makes sense. But it was a wonderful combination because I could drink, get high, take a snort, drink more, get high, take a snort. And it was like, man, it was just like everything, all the shackles were off, you know, and it was, there's Bob Dylan had a song back at that time saying, if dogs run free, why can't we? And we were the dogs and we were running free. And it was a lot of fun, a lot of fun. And a lot, you know, just so many things, music, sex, drugs, rock and roll, all that time, it was just an absolute ball. But then I met this young, when I came back from Provincetown, I actually had a little incident happen to me down there, shared an illegal needle with somebody who had hepatitis. So I came back from Provincetown with hepatitis, so a welcome to that. And luckily for me, it was Hep B, and came back. My father rescued me again, came down and picked me up, brought me back. And I still don't have any residual results from it, but then started doing all the same stuff around the Worcester area and concerts, just having a ball, working manual labor, just because, you know, that's, I wasn't going to do anything. My father did get me a scholarship to Worcester State College because he was involved with the Knights of Columbus and they contributed that I went to for one day because I got there at 8:30 in the morning after being out the night before, badly hungover, and my first class was geometry. And it was like I walked in, listened to this, and you know, Pythagorean theorems, no, went out of there. Played ping pong for 2 months before I told my parents, and then just went on my very merry way. But I met this young lady at an outdoor concert, and there is something that part of this story that I look back as being a seminal moment in my life. And she liked to do everything that I like to do. She liked to drink, liked to do drugs, liked to do parties. So of course, fell in lust. We ended up getting married. Moved down to Highland Street in Worcester, which was sort of the Haight-Ashbury of Worcester. I'm working a second shift job at Norton Company, which is an abrasive factory where you get paid piecemeal for lifting grinding wheels all day long in the oven department. And you notice I said before I liked amphetamines before, so I could lift a lot of grinding wheels and make some very good money. And the nice part was I didn't have to wake up in the morning. You know, it was a 3 to 11 job, so I could wake up at 2. Get high and go into work and then get out of work at 11 and the bars were open till 1 and they were right around the corner. Bring home maybe 10 or 12 people after the bars were shut and party in my house and just do this day after day. But then this woman, she came out and she said something to me that it was just flabbergasted me. She said, you know, Mike, do you ever think that maybe you shouldn't bring home 12 to 15 people every night? You think maybe we should start saving some money for a house and maybe start looking at maybe having kids someday? And I looked at her and I did not recognize her. And I had been with her for a little while. I said, who is this alien? And unfortunately, what happened from there is what I've looked back and found out. Anytime any person, job, situation, institution tried to get between me and a drink, they had to go. They just had to go. And it wasn't even a fair fight. And unfortunately, the ones that loved me the most, her, my parents, my friends, they're the ones that went slow, you know, and I just grind them down and grind them down until they couldn't handle it anymore. And the smart people, they just left. And it was just, and I was just on a massive run at this time. I was really drinking around the clock. I'm about 22, 23 years old. This job that I had at Norton Company, the Cambodian War was going on now. Vietnam War had just ended. And they're just trying to get any warm body into this job. But they came to me and they said, Mike, you're a good guy, but we got to let you go. You know, some days you don't come to work. Some days you leave at lunch. Some days you come back and you're just too much trouble. So we're going to lay you off. I got my my retirement money. It was about $1,000. Bought an ounce of cocaine. This was in about August of 1975. I went on a run that I remember about three things between 1975 and April of 1976. And those three things weren't pretty, what I do remember. And I woke up in a hospital, Holden Hospital, 1976, with the doctor looking over me. And the doctor said, hey, kid, I got something to tell you. I said, what's that? And I was coming out of a fog. I don't know. I'd been in the coma. I to this day, I don't know how long. It was a month, 6 weeks, something like that. And I was coming out of it slow. And I said, what's that? And he said, you're paralyzed. And I said, yeah. And what I found out was I woke up paralyzed from the waist down and bilateral sciatic nerve damage. Now, what's positive about that is so those nerves regenerated over a period of about 6 weeks in that hospital to the tops of my knees, but that's where it stopped. So to this day, that was 1976. So, you know, we're about what, 45 years later than that. For me to get up and walk out of the house, I have to slip on a pair of braces, strap on those braces and get into my shoes. I can't walk outside without them. So, and when the doctor said that, my response was, well, I deserved it. And it was just automatic. And it wasn't like I was, doing the drama, but you did what I did. You got the results of what I got. And I actually, they gave me a wheelchair there and I was delivering mail in the hospital. You know, I'm the guy with the big smile because it was a smile that had a little crook on the way up and a little crook on the way down. But what that smile was basically was saying was, don't get too close. Just don't get too close. Didn't want anybody in. And got out of that hospital. My first wife left. She just beat feet, you know, left with no forwarding address. And I was able to make an amends some 24 years after that. But I didn't blame her for leaving. You know, the fact was, if I could have left myself, I would have at this time. And what happened with this, my parents took me back and got me settled for a while. And I was just sort of getting along, but it was just like, nope, this isn't working. And I'm in their backyard, but I'm still smoking pot because I still got a little bit of pot going in their backyard. And I stayed in my parents' house and yard for about 6 months. And I always like to write. And I remember at the end of that 6 months, I wrote in this little journal, it's been 6 months since I've had a drink. I've got this lick now. Boom. Put a dot on a piece of paper. Just at the same time that a couple of friends came over and said, okay, we're going to get you out of here. We're going to take you out to a concert. And I was on crutches by this time. I had gotten out of the wheelchair and I ended up being taken up to an outdoor concert at Worcester Polytech. And I crutched into this concert and I was telling my friends, I'm not going to drink. You shouldn't drink either, but you know, I'm not going to drink and I'm getting high and everything, but I'm just not going to drink. Walked into this concert and I've got four younger sisters and one of my younger sister's best friends decided it would be fun to hustle her black sheep older brother's, hustle him who just got out of law. So she came walking up to me and said, "Hi, Mike, how you doing?" Big smile on my face. I'm right back to junior high when I did not know how to talk to a woman without a drink in me. My mouth turned to peanut butter. I reached over to my friend who had a six pack on the ring on his belt, opened up that beer and had it and turned around and said, "Hey, how you doing?" Off and running again. I had no defense against that first drink. And what happened to me over the next period of time? I mean, it was just, we call it pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Just more of the same stuff, harder, deeper. I ended up meeting another woman. She met all my criteria at this time. I met her in a bar. She was the bartender. So, and we started going out. So my drinks were free. She also had a little girl and lived in public housing. She lived on welfare and she invited me to come live with her. So I came and lived with her. My rent was free. And this poor little girl that was down there. And then we just went along for a while. But I, even down at this place, it just got to be too much. Just kept on getting worse and worse and worse. I'm angry. I'm frustrated. I'm paralyzed. I'm just, why me? Poor me, poor me, pour me a drink. And it was just, but I hit a point where I realized that I crossed a major line, that I was just in the life, they call it. This was it. That's fine. I'm on a disability check. I don't need to work. And that's what it is. And went through a few couple of years down there. But I started a series of getting arrested and always had the trump card to play. Oh, I'm paralyzed. Don't hurt me. Don't hit me. The policemen coming in and everything. And they could do that. But after about, too many of these, they finally had enough of me. And so they basically told me that you got a choice. And this was somewhere in 1979. It was right after another seminal moment for me that my dad, who was the Army Master Sergeant, I was his oldest son. And, he was like a John Wayne type of guy, brought up six kids, just did everything by the book. Great guy. And he had this son with hair out to here, an alcoholic. I had bloated up to about 238 pounds on pickled eggs and beer. I mean, it was just, I'm sure he looked at me and just said, "Here's my boy," and just said, and the things that they went through, especially during that period of time where I ended up in the hospital. But, I just wasn't, like I said, it wasn't a fair fight. So, and I just went after a final arrest, bunch of detoxes, a halfway house. And really what happened is in these detoxes and halfway houses, I learned the tricks. I learned the tricks of the street people, of what to do to stay out and get out of this trouble. But sooner or later, it all caught up. And when I ended up with this last arrest, this policeman said to me, "Mike, you got two choices. We're either going to put you into the House of Correction for an extended period of time, or you can get on antabuse. And if you get on antabuse, we will let you out one more time." So, and the antabuse I had heard about, you take a pill and you can't drink on it. So I did that. I took that pill and they got me on it for about 2 weeks in the hospital. And I came out and I knew I couldn't drink. So here I am, I'm got out of here. I'm about 238 pounds, but I can't drink and I'm on antabuse. So I could still get high and do all this other stuff. And I would see some friends. And after about a week or two, people would say, "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" I said, "Fine, I'm not drinking." And I wasn't getting arrested. All of a sudden, a little weight was starting to come off. But then after a month, month and a half, somebody would say, "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" I'd say, "Fine, I'm not drinking." And then after about 2 or 3 months, somebody would say, "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" I'd say, "Fine, I'm not drinking, and it's really none of your GD business how I'm doing." And what I got a firsthand lesson in was, it's not the drink. It's not the drink. The drink is an end result of all of this. This was the obsession for drinking. Even though I knew all the problems that were out there, all the reasons why I shouldn't drink, I'm on this drug to keep me away from drinking. I'm trying to do everything I can. It's just absolutely killing me to do this. And it was just really, really, really crazy. And I ended up doing about another month of this. And then I remember taking my bottle of Anabuse, looking out the back door, putting my hand up to the sky and said, God, if this is sobriety, you can have it, because this is terrible. Now, I've since learned, obviously, that isn't sobriety. That's abstinence from alcohol. But I was so messed. I was more messed up during this time than I ever was drinking. Just my mind was just crashing every which way. And I went and I sat in a friend of mine's Heartbreak Hotel trailer park. I spent a weekend with Roger. Roger's drinking away. I can't drink. I'm on Anabuse. I'm getting high. And I had two plans. I was either going to go to AA. I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in the detoxes and the halfway house. And, you know, it was all cool for all the folks that needed it, but I certainly didn't need it. But, you know, I said I was either going to go to AA or I was going to blow my brains out. And Roger had a gun in the house. And I found out that when I woke up paralyzed, that there was a note. So during that time, sometime I wrote a note and took a lot of pills. And that's how I ended up in the coma. And I'm either going to go to AA or blow my brains out. And they were both equally as bad a choice, AA or blow my brains out. And then at 12 midnight, the drama of the alcoholic of February 21st, going into February 22nd of 1981, I put out my last joint and I looked over at Roger and I said, Roger, I'm going to AA. And Roger's drunk and he just went, oh. And that morning when I got up, I went back to my mom, who basically said to me, don't come back here until you stop drinking and stop drugging. I just can't handle you anymore with this. And this was the last person. This was my last safe haven. So, and I went over to her and I said, Mom, I've got to stop. Got to stop. I need help. I know I need help. I don't have a car. I don't have anything. I need to be able, I'm going to go to AA. So she got me out to around the corner from where the AA meeting house was. There was this little rooming house in Worcester. And I mean, this meeting house was right up above the PIP shelter, the public inebriate program. And this rooming house was right around the corner. And this was in a bad, bad, bad part of Worcester. You know, the drug dealing, this is where the people were walking out of the PIP shelter. But for $30 a week, I got this rooming house. I was on a disability check that I made $700 a month. I moved into this rooming house and it was like, I really liked it there. You know, all of a sudden I had no responsibilities. I had this check. I really didn't go there. I didn't go to AA to quit drinking. The God's honest truth is I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason and one reason only. It was a safe place. I knew I could walk in the door, shake somebody's hand, get a cup of coffee, sit down, be quiet. And the people that were looking for me for the money that I owed them, because in that last 6 months where I was on the Anabuse, I was trying to find something that could satisfy that desire to do something. And I went on a mad cocaine run. And such a big run that I went from 238 pounds to 160 pounds. I begged, borrowed, and stole everything that I could. I owed everybody and their brother all around the area, and they were looking for me. But I knew that the type of people that were looking for me would probably not come and look at an AA meeting. You know, they were just not going to set foot in there. So I was able to sit down and get in there and sit down and go sit in these AA meetings and feel very comfortable. I mean, the meetings there were incredible. I mean, you had people that were coming up from the shelter. My wife remembers there was this little old woman there. I don't know how she lasted. She was probably in her 60s, street woman. And she would sit there and moan, just, All the time. And you'd have these people walking in, people walking out, but they would have meetings. They would have two meetings a day there. They would have a 9:30 in the morning discussion meeting, and they would have a noontime speaker meeting. And I just went in there, and it was just me and just quiet, and didn't really shake anybody's hand or anything, but I just sat there and just watched these meetings going by. And then all of a sudden it was like, okay, this isn't too bad. Maybe I can do this for a little while, but I knew it wasn't going to be long lasting. But then what happened was I went back to my rooming house one night, went to bed, and then woke up the next morning, and the pink cloud of not drinking broke. You know, I wasn't getting high. I wasn't doing any of this stuff, but this pink cloud just broke. And it was just all of a sudden, all the emotions came crashing back. It was horrible. It was like, oh God, I wanted a drink so bad. But I crutched down to that meeting and I went around the corner, went in the front door, and a greeter saved my life. Because I walked into that meeting and I knew the guy's name and he remembered my name and he said, "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" And you know, that for me was probably one of the most attractive things that there was about going to AA meetings, because somebody remembered my name. All of a sudden I was a human being again and somebody cared and remembered my name. It was a very attractive thing. And he remembered my name, and he's a lawyer in a three-piece suit. "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" And I said, "Fine." And he said, "Well, tell your face." And, you know, and I was just all scrunched up. And I got really mad. And I started yelling at him. I said, "You know, I'm doing everything you people in AA are telling me. You know, I'm getting down on my knees and asking to be kept away from a drink. And I'm going to three meetings a day. And if this is all that this is about, you can have it. This is terrible." And he just quietly listened to me and he stopped and he said, "Well," I said, "Well, what?" And he said, "So what are you doing now? You're getting down on your knees and asking to be kept away from a drink." "Yeah, but I don't believe it, but you guys told me to do it. So yeah, okay, Mike, you're asking to be kept away from a drink. When's the last time you had a drink or a drug? Was it when you got down on your knees? Has it been since then?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I've got a suggestion for you. I think I know what's happening to you now. You're going through the obsession. When you get back home, get down on your knees again and ask for the desire and obsession for a drink or a drug to be removed." And I'm there, geez, with these people, what are they, crazy? But I crutched back to my room. That was a 9:30 meeting that went till like, they were hour and a half meetings then. At least this meeting was. So it ended at 11. I crutched back to my room, and I lived up on the top floor. And Worcester is known as the Seven Hills City. So, and I was on the highest hill around the area. There was nothing that could see out my window, but I pulled down all my shades, all three of them, because I didn't want a squirrel to see me pray. That was my relationship with the higher power. This was like, and I just got down on my knees and said, "Whatever is helping these AA people, please help me. I can't take this anymore." And I didn't get a burning bush. I didn't get anything like that. But all of a sudden that black cloud lifted and I found I could breathe. It was like that weight on my chest was taken off and I could breathe. And it was like, whoa. And I went back to the noontime meeting after that. And it was such a dramatic change in me that I actually had somebody at that meeting accuse me of nipping, because the change in me was that radical, that I was so miserable when I left and I came back. And it was, and it almost sent me right back again, because he accused me of nipping. And this guy went to my Thursday, it was a Thursday, he went to our Thursday night meeting, because I went to three meetings a day. And I was just so pissed off that I made a plan that I was going to go back to my room after this meeting. And then I was going to go and get drunk. And then his name was Mike also. And I was going to go find Mike down at that meeting that night. And I was going to go beat him up and then go out and drink keep going again, because this is what AA people were like, enough of this, this is it. And so, but something said, you know, don't go get drunk now. Mike's in pretty good shape. I've got braces on my legs. You don't want to really get hurt. So why don't you go down there when you're sober, you know, and cold clock them when you're sober, and then go out and get drunk. And that was my whole plan. But a little miracle had happened a couple of days before that was that I was at a night meeting around the corner. It was a discussion meeting. And the topic of the meeting was temporary sponsorship. And at that time, I said, oh. And I walked up to the guy who led the meeting and I said, will you be my temporary sponsor? He said, sure. And one time in my life did I use this person as a sponsor. But he went to that meeting also. And when I walked into that meeting that night, he could see it all over my face. He said, get over here. What's wrong with you? And I looked at him and Mike was over in that corner. But I went over and I looked at it. His name was Bill. And he said, what's wrong? And I told him what happened. And I told him what Mike accused me of. And he looked at me and he said, but I believe you. And it was like, just that made it all right. The only time I ever used him for a sponsor, he saved my life, just like that greeter saved my life. All these little doors, all these little things that happened along the way. And it was like, oh, okay, let that go. And then I started to get to know the people at the meetings. And for me, I found out that there was basically three types of people that walked into meetings. Ones that walked in and walked right back out. The ones that walked in stayed, but they were miserable. Life is terrible. My boss is a you know what. My wife is you know, but I'm not going to drink. And then there was this other group of people over on the other side that seemed like, you know, they had problems. People died. They lost jobs, but they seemed okay. And I gravitated towards those people, you know, and started saying, what do you do? And they said, well, Mike, you know, you got to change. I said, what do I got to change? And they laughed and said, everything, but don't worry about that. I said, well, how do I do it? They said, come along with us, do what we do, and we'll show you how to do it. And they brought me to these funny little meetings up at Holy Cross College called STEP meetings, you know, and they had a Monday night STEP meeting and a Friday night STEP meeting. And the Monday night step meeting, they had like four rooms and the big crowds of people in the corridor, but they had four separate rooms and two rooms of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 for the newcomers, and then rotating the steps in the other rooms. And what I would do on Mondays, I would go to the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, but on Friday, I would go and listen to what the big guys did, you know, the ones that had moved further on. And I would go see what type of journey that they had and then just listen to them. And I mean, some incredible people there. California people probably don't know, but there was this guy, John the Indian, that was a legend, a Mi'kmaq Indian who got sober in men's rooms and Salvation Army, couldn't read or write, turned into one of the best speakers in the world. His language wasn't that great, but he spoke from the heart. And I had people like this and Father Fred, and man, I just looked at these people and just said, they were just such incredible, and I sopped it up. And for me, what I got was I got an Ivy League education in alcoholism. And you know what it cost me at that time? 25 cents in the basket every time. And it was like, geez, this is absolutely great. And I also had something to tell people, because now, you know, I started getting sober at 29. So now I'm 30, and people would say, you know, I'd see people from that I knew from before. And they say, so Mike, what are you doing? You know, they're saying, oh, I've got this job and I've got two kids and everything. And, you know, I couldn't just say, I'm going to meetings or whatever. But what I could say, I'm going to Holy Cross College. And I could smile at them, and it was the absolute truth. I was going to Holy Cross College, and I got that education. And what happened to me was this group of people, they put me back together one step at a time. You know, and probably the biggest gift outside of the gift of life that my mother gave me that I've ever had in my life was I had a surrender. And nothing I did to earn that surrender. I don't believe that surrender is earned. Surrender is grace. Surrender is God's grace to me, because all of a sudden I give up. But I had to stay given up. And I was told that you can't stay given up unless you work the rest of the steps. So from getting down on my knees and asking to be kept away from a drink, and it worked, it was like, oh, okay, this works. And then for asking the desire and obsession to be removed, all of a sudden I was able to say, there is a higher power. And I didn't have to define it, because I heard somebody recently say, and I believe in this fully, you know, I can't define and I can't understand my higher power. If I could understand my higher power, it wouldn't be a higher power, because I've got a human brain and a human brain doesn't understand a higher power. But I do know that I had empirical evidence that there was a higher power, because I asked in my hour of need to be kept away from the physical. And then I asked in my hour of need to be kept away from the mental. And so when I went to, and somebody said, okay, now it's time to go to the third step. And with that third step, I mean, it boggled me at first, but, you know, made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God, as I didn't understand him, her, or it. And it's just like, what is all that? But I had a great sponsor. And my sponsor said, you know, Mike, for an alcoholic, and look what it says, that you're turning your will and your life. And what did you bring in from your will and your life? A broken alcoholic bum that came in here. And what are they asking you to do is to turn it over to God's care. And what is God's care for an alcoholic? God's care for an alcoholic is to work the rest of the steps. And if you want to know if you're taking a third step, pick up a pen and a piece of paper, write, my name is Mike Nicholson and I am an alcoholic and this is my fourth step. You've done that, you've taken a third step and you're on the road. And I did that and I wrote my fourth step and I spent probably, I have to sort of go back a little bit, because along this way, if you see a square that says Claire N and there's two people up there, there was also this young lady that I had seen in meetings, and it was like, ooh, you know, but her sponsor and my sponsor both had got together and said, you know, we got to watch this, you know, it's we got to watch for the dating on the AA campus. So they set criteria, and what their criteria was, either wait a year or until you did your fourth and fifth step. Well, golly gee, not only did I want to turn my life and will over, but I wanted to start being able to ask this woman out for a date. So I got my pen and piece of paper and I wrote my fourth step and then made a date with Father Fred up at Holy Cross College. And I really thought, that I was going to curl this guy's hair from what my story was like and everything. But what happened was, when I went up to go meet with him and he opened up the door of the rectory, And I realized I was going to tell all this stuff in there, cold bead of sweat went right down my spine. It was like, oh God, I'm going to do something big here. I'm going to have to tell this guy that I'm afraid. And it was a scary, and I was not a fearless fifth step, because I came in and I hunkered down, didn't look him in the eye, and I started sharing my fifth step. Couple of times he had to get up and put his hands on my shoulders and say, slow down, have a cup of coffee, boom, boom, boom. But I unloaded everything. And I hear people, after they do their fifth step, they talk about, oh, all of a sudden they're free, they're this, they're that. What I saw when I did my fifth step is I realized that there's a difference. I knew everything that was on my fourth and fifth step. Well, obviously I did them, but taking it from in here where I can rationalize everything and then putting it on a pen to a piece of paper, that changed it a little bit. But where the real change was, when I was telling God, myself, and another person what was on there, because I realized afterwards that I was listening to myself through his ears and his eyes. And it was like, I looked and just really got the understanding of what a disease I had, what a sickness. Everything I based my life on was false. It was just wasted time. And thank God I'm here now. But I walked out of that fifth step with the biggest headache that there could be. And I was ready to work the rest of the steps. And it was like, for me, it was just the magic. I'm a big believer that, unfortunately, the big book doesn't say much about steps 6, 7, and 8. Because they weren't really living lives afterwards after this time. They wrote this before they all, you know, basically there was 100 of them that got sober, less than 100 actually, but they hadn't gone out and lived life. But then Bill went out, lived life, and had the worst depressions of his life and realized that, you know, this thing about humbly being entirely ready to have God remove the defects and then humbly ask, that isn't something that you just do. Trampoline over those steps and then go out and make amends. You don't even know what your defects are until you experience them sober again. And they come back and they hammer you over and over and over again. So in the 12 and 12, they do such a wonderful job on 6, 7, and 8. And being able to work through these things and realizing that I just had to try repeatedly. Because what are my defects? Pride, anger, envy, greed, gluttony, lust, sloth. Well, if I didn't have pride, I wouldn't have taken a shower this morning. Anger, that's the fight or flight syndrome. You know, these are all instincts inside of us. You know, lust, if we didn't have any lust, there'd be none of us in these squares here because there'd be no procreation. But I couldn't tell where an instinct and a defect, they're on different sides of the cat, you know, where did the instinct end and where did it turn into a defect? So I had to go to that higher power and humbly ask and say, you know, take all of me and please remove every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and others. And I really want to do your bidding. And it's just, they came back and they hit me straight in the face. And I just had to live my way through them, but just keeping on willing to try again, try again, try repeatedly. And in the eighth step is so beautiful because I had to make another list because the fourth and fifth were all about me, but the eighth step was all about the people I had harmed, all about my relationships with people. And I had to realize, you know, I had to make that list, forgive the people because some of those people didn't live up to my unreasonable demands. So they were on there for a reason. They done me wrong. But then I had to find out what instincts in me, character defects in me, made me harm people and made get that judgment, do things like that. And what doing that eighth step has done, it was really got me to understand my part in every relationship in life. And when I can learn that, I could have some new ways of dealing with people in life going forward. And when actually from doing that, the ninth step amends really weren't all that tough. You know, there are a couple of them. I mean, I went back to that first wife and I thought she was going to say, oh, you know, don't worry about it. We were just kids then. No, I had to go and sit and listen to how much I had hurt her and all the things I did there. And my job was, my amend to her was to sit there and listen, to ask her if there's anything I could do to make it right. She said, nope, nothing you can make it right. And to be okay with that. And just to say, if there ever is anything I can do, I'll be willing to do it. And so I went through my amends like that. What happened now, I wasn't Mike the drunk. I wasn't Mike that had to worry about who was looking at me down the street, who would find me. Now I'm Mike, the sober alcoholic that is changing his life. And then they brought me into what my sponsors back then called, they grouped the steps into groups of three. And the first three are to clear up, the next three are to clean up, the next three are to grow up. And now here I am at 10, 11, and 12. These next three are the live it up steps. Because when I'm doing a 10th step every day, I can keep it to one day at a time. I can clear up the mess in that 10th step and it's done. I don't add to the chain. When I'm doing the 11th step in the morning and spending some time and asking my higher power, what do you want me to do? And then I can sit and listen. I've got some direction. And I had a great sponsor that gave me the best way to look at this. from a kid who moved a lot growing up. And he said, you know, Mike, you move into a new neighborhood. You drive your car down the road. You see your neighbors. You wave at the neighbors. You drive your car in the driveway, into the garage, shut the garage door. What type of relationship do you have with your neighbors? You have a waving relationship. How do you get to get a good relationship with your neighborhood, your neighbors? You get out of the car and spend some time with them, right? Yeah. Same thing with God. You want to have a good relationship with the God of your understanding or non-understanding? Carve out some time and spend that time every day and listen, prayer and meditation. And since I have done that, the practice has evolved. It's absolutely amazing. It's made my life worthwhile. And then that 12 step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, in the second appendix in the book, big book, it's called The Spiritual Experience. And they state it very simply, because it's not burning bushes. It's a personality change sufficient to bring about a recovery from alcoholism. And it manifests itself in many different ways, but it comes as a result of these steps. And my person and my personality changed. And I have one responsibility since then, is to be able to carry this message to other people, carry AA's message, not theory, but how it worked for me. And then another sponsor said, the most important seven words of all those 12 steps are the last seven, to practice these principles in all our affairs, because that makes me go right back and do it over and over and over. And living a perfectly imperfect human life over the almost 41 years since all this has gone on, and living that perfectly imperfect human life with that young lady that I met that's in square that says Claire and up there since then, had a hell of a life. You know, it's real life. I would take another 5 hours to tell you how great life was, with all the ups, all the downs. We've moved 20 times ourselves, you know, all over the country. What's the first thing that we do, though? We find AA meetings. We find people. We find our tribe, because we need our tribe with all this, because we can't do it alone. The outline's in the book, but you got to get out and you got to do it. And for me, the best part about Alcoholics Anonymous is when I'm working with somebody else. Because when I'm working with somebody else, I'm seeing myself when I'm working with somebody else and realizing, oh. And I have one saying that I heard, and I think it's probably the most important saying to me now, because it continues on this way: more will be revealed and more will be required. My job is just to keep on doing this. There is no there. I'm lucky to be alive. I've been blessed with friends. I've been blessed to be able to sit around and talk with you folks about what happened. It gave all those things that I had, no matter how far down the scale I went, I see where my experience can help others. Now, it does say you regret the past. You won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. I could honestly say that I do regret much of the past, not for me, but what I did to other people. But I certainly don't want to shut the door on it, because I never want to do that to anybody else again. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Mike. That was absolutely marvelous. And Brian, thank you for selecting and Mike to speak, and for just being a part of this day. Well, we're 5 minutes ahead of time.
Hey, Rick, butt in for just a moment? And I'm going to ask everyone if they want to unmute and just say thank you to Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Me too.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah.
A gift for all of us. A gift for all of us.
What
a
blessing. Yes.
You are one of the miracles.
Yes.